just finished a 15-day tour in Germany.
So where
15
are you
different
in Germany?
Cities. I'm right now, actually just right now in Basel. This is the last stop right in the border here.
Okay.
Yeah,
what time
so
is
I just,
it? It must be 4 in the morning.
It is exactly 4 in the morning.
Wow,
that's
so you
correct.
Just got up.
I actually went to sleep for 2 hours and got up to do this call.
Hi, everyone,
the last
and welcome to
tour.
World Spirituality, Spirit's Next Move teleseries, presented by the Center for World Spirituality. Our hosts for the series are Dr. Mark Goffney and Mariana Kaplan, and tonight we welcome Michael Murphy. In this rare dialogue with one of the great pioneers of the human potential movement, an important precursor to the emergence of world spirituality, trailblazing spiritual teacher and author Mark Goffney will mine Michael Murphy's great well of resources in order to articulate the great possibilities of Spirit's Next Move, as well as the lessons hard won from Murphy's 4 decades in the human potential movement. Together, they will chart the critical tenets and practices that constitute a world spirituality. Michael Murphy is the co-founder and chairman of Esalen Institute and the author of both fiction and nonfiction books that explore evidence for extraordinary human capacities. During his 40-year involvement in the human potential movement, he and his work have been profiled in The New Yorker and featured in many magazines and journals worldwide. Murphy is the author of The Future of the Body, The Life We Are Given with Jordan Leonard, In the Zone, Transcendent Experience in Sports with Ray White, The Physical and the Psychological Effects of Meditation with Stephen Donovan, God and the Evolving Universe with James Redfield and Sylvia Timbers, among others. And our host for tonight, Dr. Mark Goffney, is a rabbi and iconoclastic teacher of Kabbalah and world spirituality. He is a core founder and faculty member of iEvolve Global Practice Community, as well as director of the Integral Life Spiritual Center of Integral Life. He has written 7 books, including the national bestseller Soul Prints and The Mystery of Love, a Kabbalistic exploration of the relationship between the sexual, the erotic, and the sacred. Goffney's teaching is marked by a deep transmission of open heart, love, and leading-edge provocative wisdom. Goffney's path of personal evolution in both the agony and the ecstasy of what he calls sacred autobiography, woven together with profound reverence and reading of sacred texts, have formed the context for his personal realization. It is from this place of brokenhearted humility, radical joy, and sacred audacity that he teaches. And it is with great joy to welcome you to World Spirituality, Spirit's Next Move.
Hello, everyone. Hello, Michael. Welcome to the call.
Good to be with you, Mark.
Good to be with you. We're live on the air, and it was delightful getting to talk to you for a couple minutes before the call. I'm calling in everyone from Germany, actually Switzerland, right on the border. Just finished with our friend Diane Hamilton, who's a teacher of Zen, a 15-day tour of Germany. We've got that feeling, Michael, where you've been on the road every day, 15 cities in 15 days. So we're at the very, very last stop and delighted to be here talking about world spirituality.
I'm impressed. It's 4 a.m. over there.
Yeah, it is 4 a.m. over here, early in the morning, right at the time when the rooster crows. And so hopefully I won't be crowing, but would love to talk to you about it and ask a few questions. Because, Michael, you really have really been, in some deep sense, one of the implicit trailblazers of world spirituality. I mean, your great, great experiment, we might call it, at Esalen and in your other work, with integral transformative practice, was really, in some sense, if one would look at it from the outside, and you'll correct me if I'm off, but was really an attempt to gather best practices in some deep sense from the different world traditions, free them of what might be called their kind of dogmatic or ethnocentric context, and, weave them together into a larger metasystem of practice. And so in that, deep sense, right, the great laboratory, right, of Esalen and integral transformative practice really was a harbinger of some evolutionary emergent, which we're calling, a potential world spirituality. Is that a fair way to look at Esalen and integral transformative practice, Michael?
That's well said, Mark. That's a very good, clear statement. Yeah. Right. And my book, The Future of the Body, was my most ambitious book in this regard. And in it, I reviewed all sorts of practices and all sorts of experiences and laid it out in an evolutionary worldview that from the vantage point of which I believe we can see that all our human attributes, everything about us, how we perceive the world, how we engage the world, how we know the world, what we do, all of it is in line with a long evolutionary development. All our attributes are inherited from our primate ancestors, and all of them give rise to supernormal expressions of themselves. And so I did that in that book, and then made a series of proposals for practice, and drawing, as you put it, from traditions worldwide, Hindu, Buddhist, Christian, Jewish, Muslim, etc., but also from contemporary psychotherapies, somatic practices, and other transformative practices that have been emerging in modern times. And as you put it, winnow away the what William James called the overbeliefs, unwarranted beliefs that often accompany people's illuminations and breakthroughs, but which they feel they have to attach to their experience. So yes, Esalen and that book and my work has involved this winnowing out, this attempt to winnow out all this that's been given to us today in the global village.
Well, that's incredibly exciting, Michael. And we're deeply in your debt, and it's just a delight to be talking to you because you really were, I think all through the ages, people have thought in different ways. There's been kind of, foreshadowings of what a world spirituality might look like at different times. And maybe the latest foreshadowing were the perennialists, the great perennial philosophers, who Aldous Huxley perhaps, captured best in his book by that same name, but really from, Fritzlaff Schuhan, William Stoddard, people like Thomas Mann, this group of people who are really looking for this, perennial thought, but in some deep sense, they were each of them still both profoundly metaphysical, kind of locked in metaphysical trappings, and didn't quite bring us to the realm of practice. And I think one of the huge breakthroughs, right, that you made, right, in both the future of the body and in Esalen was really, it was all about practice. The practice really, really made the difference in some deep way.
Well, that's very generous of you, Mark, and I appreciate it. I agree with you. That is exactly what we have tried to do at Esalen. Wonderful young professor of religious studies, a historian of religions, Jeff Kripal, has written a big book about Esalen called Esalen, The Religion of No Religion. He took that phrase from my teacher, Friedrich Spiegelberg, who succeeded Paul Tillich in Dresden in the 30s and got out in time in 1937 out of Germany. But he was a professor at Stanford, and he wrote a book called The Religion of No Religion and introduced me to the through comparative religious studies and then the work of Sri Aurobindo and others. In any case, this book by Jeff Kripal goes through all that, and he frames this very much in the way you're framing it, that this is, Esalen represented an attempt that a lot of us, that you and your colleagues and I and a lot of our colleagues, Ken Wilber and others, are trying to make to own up to this extraordinary privilege we have today of drawing on these many traditions and mounting practices that are informed by the best in them. So, yes, this is an incredible moment in human history, and we are all, I believe, whether we stick with the traditions to which we were born or not, members of the global village, and that gives us many riches to enrich our practice, even if we stick in a traditional practice.
Yeah, no, I think that sounds so completely right. And Michael, before we actually try and, you know, duck in or dip in very deeply and directly specific practices, right, that might actually constitute an integral transformative practice, and the specific practices that might be necessary, or buckets of practices that might be necessary for world spirituality, I want to actually begin with a challenge that Houston Smith put to us, and ask you about what we talked to Houston about a few weeks ago when we visited him, and God bless him with good health, and he was strong and articulate and incredibly charming and funny, and, you know, very, very deeply concerned with this issue of a world spirituality. So Houston was very concerned with what you might call the challenge of, you know, is world spirituality ultimately dilettantish, right? You know, is it, you know, ultimately, you know, a lack of surrender, a lack of commitment? Is it a place for the, you know, ego to hide out because you never need to surrender, you know, nor to any tradition, nor to any teacher? You get to kind of move from place to place, you know, and you don't really ever enter deeply enough into a path, you know, with that commitment to a path, with that sense of obligation to a path, with that sense of surrender, which is always necessary in some sense, you know, on the spiritual path. And so Houston, you know, kind of came down and said, you know, Mark, how do you and all the other people talking about world spirituality actually respond, right, to that challenge? And that your ability to respond to that challenge is going to be the litmus test as to whether a world spirituality really emerges as this great evolutionary emergent, or becomes just another, you know, fad, or just another even semi, he was kind of very sharp, semi kind of narcissistic, you know, modern, postmodern self-involvement, you know, refusing to actually engage a particular path. So I told Houston that, you know, we were going to be talking to you and to Claudia Naranjo, and that I, besides my response to that question, we would put the question to you, so we could actually kind of grapple with that at the outset. Is that a fair question?
Well, it's a question he's put to me himself.
And okay, so that's fantastic.
I've known Houston for 40 years, and to know Houston is to love Houston. He's one of the most lovable guys on the planet. And my answer first is absolutely yes, by opening up to all these practices and acquainting oneself with them, one can become a glorious dilettante, no doubt about it. But it's our choice to do that. But on the other hand, if you go and if you become a traditionalist, you can become a dogmatist, a fundamentalist. You can get too narrow. So whatever path you choose, if you want to make it such a dichotomy, you know, to stick to a traditional path, you can become narrow and rigid. If you open yourself to the global village, you can be, you know, 10 miles wide and 1 inch deep. Right. But I believe first that you can draw on all these riches that are given to us and form a practice. Now, let's talk about that in a few minutes. But first, another answer to Houston is simply this, that every religion, every tradition has gone through a phase in which it brings together many disparate elements. Catherine Albanese, one of the great doyens of modern religious studies, a professor now at UC Santa Barbara, has written a big, big book on this, The History of Religions, and pointing out the combinative, she calls it the combinative aspects of it. There's no truly pure Judaism.
Right.
The various definitions of Judaism, what incorporated it, is very complex. There's no pure Christianity. Many cults say they are the way, but other Christian cults say no, we're the way. Not just Catholics versus Protestants, but go back to the Council of Nicaea.
Mm-hmm.
Go back to Constantine. Go back to the very beginning centuries when the Gnostic influences were coming in, when you had esoteric cults such as the Qumraners and the Essenes, Jewish mystical cults, which very well may have influenced the historic Jesus. We don't know for sure, but who knows? And to certainly to look at Buddhism, the diverse influences that have poured into Buddhism in all its manifestations after the Buddha himself. And Hinduism fully acknowledges its vast complexity. Hinduism is unashamed
yes.
of its vast complexity. So everywhere you look in the great religious traditions that Houston not only celebrates, but beautifully educates the world about, according to Catherine Albanese and most religious scholars today, Mark, they were always combinative. So this is essentially a bum rap. And I'm glad Houston put it as a challenge. Yes, practice has to have integrity and depth and so forth. And when George Leonard and I started Integral Transformative Practice, ITP, that was why we did it, to really see if we could mount a long-term disciplined integral practice for people who are not in monasteries or ashrams. That's my first response to Houston's challenge.
No, great, Michael.
This is worth a long conversation, though, Mark. It's a complex thing, and there's a lot of ramifications to it. It's a great and worthy challenge. But those are my answers.
No, that's a great beginning, Michael, and thank you very much. And I actually really profoundly agree with the direction of your answer. And Houston, it was very, and I'm sure Houston may or may not be listening, but if not, we'll send him the recording. It was a very, very funny moment in the conversation where Houston, in making this point that he was trying to make, kind of critiquing the potential of world spirituality, cited, Buddhist texts, Hindu texts. And I said, Houston, in your very citing of the texts, right, in the very essence of who you incarnate as a being, you actually incarnate a kind of world spirituality, even as you remain a passionate Christian. And I want to kind of come back to that model in a second. But first, I just want to go back and
say something. When I, Houston, who I adore, he's so marvelous. And anyway, he gave me this critique when Future of the Body was coming out. He says, Mike, it's marvelous that you've pulled this all together. But he says, no one can possibly do all these things at the same time. I said, well, I'm not advocating we do them or anyone does them all at the same time. I'm saying this is their force. But I said, Houston, you practice Hatha Yoga, right? And he said, yes. And I said, you meditate. Yes, and I've heard you talk about your various ways of meditation. I mean, you're definitely influenced by Buddhism and Hinduism and all of that. And he said, yes. And I said, intellectually, you've deeply immersed yourself for decades, for more than half a century, for almost a century, in intellectual knowledge of these various practices. Yes. I said, you're a great engine of good works, so you're a karma yogi too, yes. I said, my God, you're an integral yogi. I mean, your body, mind, heart, and soul. You're doing it now. So I said, it is a performative contradiction. I mean, you're telling me, I'm talking about too much, and that, look at you. I said this to him, and he laughed, and, this is a long time ago. This is about 20 years ago, but so he himself, I would argue very strongly, has exemplified the integral spirit, but he's right. But he's rightly challenged the dilettantic impulse.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And going back, and that's just, it's great just to hear about that conversation that you guys both had.
That was a good one.
Both, that's a great story, and that's a fantastic story. And you both were just so key from different places in kind of ushering in this particular expression of new consciousness in which the world's religions, became so central, and the attempt to actually move the next step, which you took, of course, naturally emerges out of the impulse of his own work. But to go back just to something you said earlier, because I think it's just so important for our listeners and for everyone involved in this project, I really just want to just reflect it back to you and to highlight it. You know, there's this sense that people have when they point out the dangers in a world spirituality, that the only possible dangers are on the side of world spirituality. And it's kind of like when you talk about, you know, marriage in its kind of conventional context versus all the other post-conventional options. The way people describe it is marriage becomes this white picket fence where everything's perfect and idyllic and wonderful, and all the dangers and all the potential complexity and all the potential pain is always on the post-conventional side. When actually, when you look more carefully at reality, actually all of the conventional and post-conventional options in a relationship each carry their own potential danger, their own pain, right, their own complexity. And you really have to, as it were, pick your poison. You have to decide which risk and which path you're prepared to engage. So the notion that, you know, religions become this kind of white picket fence place where there's, you know, perfect surrender, perfect practice, you know, perfect ritual expression, and world spirituality becomes the place of danger, of course, is neither empirically, theoretically, existentially, psychologically, just not correct. You know, both practicing religions and by trying to engage in forming a world spirituality, each have, you know, their attendant dangers, their attendant challenges, you know, each invite us in a particular way. And we need to kind of break, as you implicitly and explicitly said, that false dichotomy between kind of the good religion, which is the virtuous and the good, and the kind of dilettantish world spirituality. Each requires a clarity of intention and a depth, you know, brought to the table. So that's just to kind of, you know, begin.
Mark, that's well said. You know, I've never heard that analogy made. You know, the marriage and practice, that's a very apt, that's a brilliant analogy. I mean, exactly. And we do have to pick our poison. I mean, there's no free lunch. I mean, if you're going to choose the integral path, you have to face the challenge of you know, the dilettantish. And now with this ITP thing that we have going, it's an experiment that started in 1992, George and I, and we wrote a book, The Life We Are Given, describing that two-year experiment. And now there are some dozens of groups around the world, you know, using the book, and there's an organization, ITPI International, that's, you know, it's embryonic. It's just beginning to form and to reinforce groups that are trying to do this. But that is, Mark, definitely front and center as a problem. How to sustain committed practice, and I do believe for virtually all of us, we do need to find our particular sanghas. The Buddha was right. Yes. You've got to seek out the sangha. You've got to find a community of fellowship. And I think for high level practice, you know, it's really good to have companions on the path. And in some of our groups, and we did this at the very beginning, to have a transformative buddy, a friend.
Mm-hmm.
I do think we can learn a lot in practice in an urban world outside of a monastery and outside of an ashram. We can learn a lot from the 12-step programs. I really do. Alcoholics Anonymous should be honored. It has as good a record as anybody in dealing with alcohol.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they really are forerunners in their own way.
Yes,
you know,
they
are.
Kind
of
it's
world spirituality.
It is a great, great thing. And one of the things, if you are truly alcoholic, and at the very bottom, you need support every day. And there's some people that need it about every 6 hours. So you have a friend, a buddy, and they you call them. I mean, if you're really making this commitment, then you meet in your group for people I've known who've done it at first every day, every night, if you are really trying to beat it. Well, in integral transformative practice, where the aim is not, you know, focused around a particular problem, but rather on growth in general, and there, the great enemy is not drink, but your old self, your old habits, the tremendous power of homeostasis. And George Mentor and I used to talk about this, that to survive, you know, the temperature of our body can fluctuate only with it, you know, what, about 8 degrees. I mean, if you get too cold or too hot, you die. And the body has a whole lot of the homeostats, you know, rheostats. It has, you know, epistats, you know, one guy about how we eat. All of these things are operational. And then the community pressures, the social pressures, everything is designed to keep us in place for survival. This is Darwinian. We are, and you could argue that all humans have a genius for homeostasis. Otherwise, you couldn't live. Now, to grow, you have to break that homeostasis often while preserving your basic foundations. For example, people who are particularly gifted in meditation and who are given to sudden ecstasies often have the problem of what that does to, first of all, your bodily chemistry. We know what it does to your neuropeptides, to the flow of endorphins and serotonin and et cetera. So it's like training for high-level fitness and athletics. You have to negotiate with your limits. If you, you know the story of the Irish miler, the guy that he took 20 seconds, it is said, off his mile time and died as he broke the tape. Well, he should have maybe just broken and taken 15 seconds off. And in other words, there is a wisdom as you break about breaking out. Now, in the great active, healthy, really effective contemplative traditions, for example, let's say in some advanced Zen training, where you have a very gifted Roshi, who can guide you into this as this stuff happens. Now, for the most of the rest of us, however, who are living lives in urban settings, who practice an integral practice, and if you want to step it up and, as it were, become a four-minute miler in some of these states, you need to negotiate with your limits. You have to build a base. And so one of the great fundamental virtues at the beginning is balance. And so we emphasize, you know, our slogan is body, mind, heart, and soul. You have to get a physical balance and work towards physical fitness and good health and so forth. And your relationships have to be functional enough to not be giving rise to one hissy fit after another, one crisis after another. You have to have a basic equanimity, and you have to have a mind that doesn't run away with each illumination and declare the millennium, and you know, and it doesn't, you don't become inflated and declare yourself, you know, the second coming overnight. This can happen. Go ahead.
No, this is you're saying so much, Michael. So what I want to do is I want to throw at you an image, and then I want to actually go back to some of the things you've said and really unpack with you in this seminal phone call what these constituent elements are of practice. Because, I mean, in each sentence you're dropping pearls. I mean, just that phrase, to negotiate with your limits, I mean, that you said about four sentences back was so fantastic. I had to kind of, you know, work on just stopping from cutting you off just to kind of highlight that phrase itself, which is worth the entire phone call, just the idea that you have to negotiate with your own limits, and what a fabulous way to put it. So I want to hold for a second and just throw at you an image just to complete, you know, one piece of our conversation from about 4 minutes ago, and then really dive into integral transformative practice and let people hear you just kind of guide us in what the constituent elements might be of practice. What are the pitfalls? What are the lessons? What do we need in our kind of spiritual toolbox of transformative practice toolbox, which is essential, what can we do without, etc. But before that, just to leave your good friend Houston Smith in good stead for a moment, I want to just, you know, share with you and get your response to, you know, a phrase we've been using just for the last 4 or 5 months. It's a very obvious one, Michael, but, you know, we always reinvent the wheel. So just let me just share it with you. When talking to Houston and to some other people in the last few months, just the phrase dual citizen, you know, came very strongly into our consciousness. I was actually with our mutual friend, Brother David, David Sendel Rast, who I know has been with you for many, many years, you know, at Esalen and many places. And with Diane Hamilton, we were teaching in Texas, and we were trying to explain the idea of what a world spirituality might look like. This was about 4 months ago. You know, and the Texans were kind of looking at us like, what are these guys talking about? We had a fantastic, you know, room of about 100 white male Republicans who thought we were out of our minds. And so at some point, you know, we said, you know, hey, you know, are you guys citizens of the United States? So they kind of looked at us, you know, it's just a spontaneous moment. And they said, well, of course we are. But aren't you guys Texans? I mean, you guys are Texans, aren't you? Well, what do you mean? Of course we're Texans. We're, you know, we're both. What do you mean you're both? Well, you're dual citizens. And the idea of dual citizen, you know, came up very strongly for us, that we're actually in this, you know, 100 years ago, if you had two passports, you were considered suspicious in some way. You know, today, it's very much the vogue to have a bunch of passports. But actually, world spirituality, the audience for world spirituality is both, you know, those tens and tens of millions of people who are profoundly beyond the traditions for whatever reason, you know, are no longer alive to them. They've kind of internalized, you know, usually unconsciously, either the modern critique demanding evidence, the postmodern critique, you know, about context within context. It's just not a live option, but they're deeply interested in spirit. Or people who are passionately committed to a tradition, right? Either, you know, their native tradition, their chosen tradition, and yet are also dual citizens, both citizens of a tradition and of world spirituality, and it would seem like integral transformative practice would benefit very strongly both groups of people. That one could actually be, and that seems to be really important for our listeners, that you actually can remain passionately committed to your Jewish practice, your Buddhist practice, your Taoist practice, your Christian practice, and really read Michael's fantastic work, right, and really begin to engage integral transformative practice without leaving behind your native or chosen tradition. Does that resonate with you, Michael?
I love that. You know, I love that. It's absolutely right. You know, I always like to use the example of Father Arupe, the great popular head of the Jesuits for so many years. You know about him.
Yes.
You know, for a while, some people thought he might be in the running to become the next pope. And, you know, the Jesuits historically have been one of the toughest orders in the Catholic Church. But he had served in Japan for a while, and so he started to meditate every day in the lotus position. So I think when he went back to Rome and was spending an hour or two every day in the lotus position, as well as on his knees in prayer, so that he was questioned by, you know, the others. Well, why are you in the lotus position? He said, because the divine can disclose itself to me in that position in a way it doesn't when I'm on my knees in prayer. And they said,
beautiful.
Well, are you still a Jesuit? He says, I'm the head of the Jesuit order. And they said, you're not a Buddhist.
That's
he
fantastic.
Says, well, when I practice, I have some Buddhist type of experience. So he would be a perfect example of your dual citizenship there, the head of the Jesuits.
That's fantastic.
I
mean, what?
Yeah, you know, I really think that we're wounded by being in the global village. Once you've had the kind of disclosure and opening that Father Arupe had, you don't want to give it up. Why? Because that is God speaking to you just as clearly as God spoke to him on his knees in prayer. So why don't you listen to God in all his or her voices? So
that's a fantastic, that's just a fantastic image. And, you know, the image that comes to mind, and then we're going to head into integral transformative practice, is really kind of that of a symphony in which everyone actually plays their own instrument, you know, but they kind of need to know that, you know, your instrument, you know, in the symphony, you need to master it to join the symphony. So you can't be a dilettante responding to Houston's critique. At the same time, you need to listen to other instruments, and yet you need to know that your instrument is an instrument. It's not the music. And from the diversity kind of emerges symphony. So it's kind of that kind of image that really animates, you know, so much of your work in such a deep way. Does that image resonate for you?
Absolutely. That's a good one. Gee, you're giving me some great images and metaphors here tonight. This is terrific.
No,
wow.
This is fantastic. It is such, Mike, I just to say, we've never met. I just moved to the Bay Area. I was in Israel for most of my adult life. And Ken, you know, our mutual colleague and friend Ken, whose own work in integral spiritual practice so clearly emerges, and Ken said so directly, you know, in many conversations, really emerges.
How long did
and,
you live in Israel?
I was in Israel for 17, 18 years. Most of my adult teaching life was in Israel, and I came to America about 4 years ago. And when I invite myself over for a cup of coffee, I'll be delighted to share that with you.
Oh, I can't wait to talk to you about it. I mean, you know, we have folks coming regularly from Israel, and we have a big project at Esalen, which we're deeply committed. We call the Abrahamic Family Reunion, Christians, Jews, and Muslims, looking at it from, you know, with the perspective of political psychology and depth psychology, and looking at the wounds and the grievances and the shadow side of the relationship of the three Abrahamic faiths, which all got spawned out of, you know, supposedly out of Abraham. So that's it's been very close to us. Anyway,
I'm looking forward to that cup of coffee. And it may not be cup of coffee; it might be green juice, but whatever it is, I am completely looking forward to that. So at this point, we're going to move from these images of Symphony of Dual Citizenship, which are really images that describe, you know, the work that you've incarnated, and go directly to your work that you express both in your work with George Leonard and your own work. You know, what would an integral transformative practice look like? And, you know, the line that we've kind of picked up to negotiate with your limits, you know, is really kind of speaks to the unique element in every practice, that no person's practice is the same on the one hand. On the other hand, you point to the need for community, you know, and community sangha, which actually requires, you know, some sort of shared language of practice, so you don't create a kind of, you know, splendid isolation of uniqueness in which you're cut off from the richness and power of community. And so maybe the first question, you know, I might ask is really comes from this place of community, and maybe I could frame the question in a particular way and then put it to you, Michael. You know, a bunch of years ago when George Bush won the presidency, well, he actually didn't win, but he became the president, even though he didn't win the popular vote. I remember talking to friends of mine. I was still in Israel then, you know, many, many liberal friends, teachers in America, who were all shocked that he won. And, you know, part of the reason was that they didn't know anyone who voted for him. And so they were completely sure that Al Gore was going to win the presidency. And they were just, you know, kind of outraged. Do you remember that kind of outrage people had in those couple of years? And I said to them, you know, I think you guys are just misunderstanding something. So when I come to America and I visit, you know, other friends in the fundamentalist community, and I see actually the power of community, you know, the depth of fellowship, you know, the kind of practice, you know, at least in theory, you know, in a man's reach to exceed his grasp of what's to heaven for, you know, at least that's where they were reaching, you know, towards the virtues and, you know, towards kind of shared vision. And, you know, when someone gets sick, you know, in the liberal progressive community, you get a couple of cards and, you know, that's it. You know, but actually in the kind of average, you know, point, you know, entry point in the kind of conservative communities, you know, the idea of community, although they would never call it sangha in a million years, it's more fellowship, is very, very powerful. And so it seems like, you know, with integral transformative practice, it needs to really, as you implicitly and explicitly say, move beyond the splendid isolation of the evolved practitioner and the formation of communities that are actually practicing together, you know, seems to be such an essential element to any kind of emergence and success. And so I want just to ask you to perhaps to speak to that notion of the necessity of sangha, number one, and number two, practically, you know, you mentioned that there is actually an emergent network of people engaged in integral transformative practice, and how might a person access that? So that kind of direction, is that a fair inquiry?
Oh, absolutely. Well, first, we, as it's working out in our, you know, relatively small community, we started in 92, and with one group, it was an experiment. There were, in each year, there was 30-some but there were actually about 50 who went through the 2 years, and we did a kind of experiment. We had measurements. It was kind of pre-scientific about the results, and we wrote a book about this, The Life We Are Given, and that in turn has spawned a number of groups, some dozens of groups, and then a few of the leaders here formed ITP, Integral Transformative Practice International, which is a 501c3 to coordinate the activities of these groups and to help them along. Now, as they're evolving, they are achieving their own flavors. Now, this is interesting. Kind of with the same basic practice regimen. And in the Bay Area now, there are 5 or 6 of these groups, one in Marin County, 2 in the East Bay, 1 on the peninsula, 1 in the city, and then there are convenings at times of the whole Bay Area community, and also people who are in groups in, say, Columbus, Ohio, and Tulsa, Oklahoma, and Houston, Texas, and elsewhere. So, and that's, say, once a year. So what we have is not only an honoring of the individual within the small groups, but a kind of honoring of the, actually a diversity already in the practices of these various ITP groups. Now, they do the kata, which George Leonard developed. You know, a kata is a ritualized set of movements.
Yes.
And in this one, it was a small encyclopedia of Aikido, which George was, practiced. He was a fifth-degree black belt. Tai Chi, some of the basic hatha yoga postures, progressive relaxation and meditation, a 40-minute ritual that exercises all your body parts and also has some strength stuff built in. So that's a shared practice among the various groups. And then the practice of affirmations, again, going back to Alcoholics Anonymous, or to the great religious orders where you take vows. It's our form of vow-taking, and to make affirmations, though, there's a way to do it with depth and that makes it much more powerful. I don't think we have time here tonight to talk about the art of vow-taking and affirmation-making, but that is another shared practice. Then staying current in relationships, so when these groups typically meet once a week as a group, although some of them will meet twice a week, but typically once a week, but practicing every day as individuals. And then there's a variety of physical fitness training regimens that spring up, but the main thing is we really try to encourage everyone to get physically fit. I tell you, it is one of the great jump starters for meditation practice, and the healthier you are, the better your relationships tend to be, let's face it. And then there's a shared, sets of meetings we have, lectures and other things to keep feeding ourselves intellectually. So these are shared activities in the Bay Area and shared with these groups in Columbus and Houston and Tulsa and elsewhere. This is just beginning, but my interest in this, and I think our basic aim, is to set an example and to find our way. Now, a lot of these folks do Buddhist retreats and do go to temple and go to church. But I would have to say, though, Mark, for our
dual citizens.
They're dual citizens, but our group is very much secular humanist. I must say that I'm not setting this up as an example, but somehow we, a very high percentage of people in ITP, as the same in Esalen, happen to be Jewish, but most don't go to temple, and that just happens to be the community in which my corner of things is evolving. it's an extraordinarily high percentage. I mean, for example, Esalen itself, half our board of trustees are Jewish and half our leaders. We have about 400 leaders a year, and half happen to be Jewish. It's just interesting. It's an interesting fact, but it's not that we're out recruiting Christians or Jews or Muslims, Hindus or Buddhists. It's just the way our corner of the world is working today. But yes, I mean, everyone, I could argue that all of us are to some degree dual citizens, but the dual citizenship, I would say, is between secular humanism and this kind of integral practice.
You know,
for the
most part,
in our community.
Yeah, I'm received, and I'm hearing that. And just to say something, you know, just funny for a second on the Jewish side, you know, it's actually completely wild how, you know, Judaism in its kind of very interesting way has produced, you know, so many leaders and so many of the different movements, you know, and at the same time, you know, people really have left behind, you know, active Jewish practice because, you know, Jewish practice paradoxically, which is so beautiful, you know, and so stunning and so deep, you know, really became in the, you know, 1950s, early 60s, you know, as the Jewish centers kind of emerged around the country and you had these kind of, you know, very strong ethnocentric commitment, you know, post-Holocaust. Part of what kind of feels like happened, Michael, is it's one of the things people don't remember about the Holocaust and all of its tragedy. And I've been here in Germany and my parents are both Holocaust survivors, is that actually in the destruction, much like happened in Tibet, you know, not to make an analogy, but when those 6,000 monasteries were destroyed, that actually a link in the chain of transmission was actually broken.
That's right.
And that was a great, great, great tragedy. And the great teachers and the masters and the oral transmission, you know, was in some sense lost for maybe a generation and a half, two generations. It's since reconstituted itself, but there was a kind of in-between place in which you had, you know, these kind of very, very committed ethnocentric Jewish thrusts that children grew up in, but really in which the spirit of the divine didn't rest. You know, they used to say big bar mitzvah, you know, a lot of bar, not a lot of mitzvah. I think that perhaps that's part of what happened there in that kind of very strange and worthy of note phenomena, really, in the American Human Potential Movement, of which you've been such a major leader.
Well, it's a striking fact. You know, you make that analogy of Tibet and the Holocaust, that now the horror of these two events, it's beyond our capacity to even grasp
it.
It's so horrible.
We can't even give a language.
But, you know, but this is an equally tough truth, that the diaspora that resulted in both cases has propelled Tibetan Buddhism and all that mystical, ethical impulse in the Jewish community out into the wide world. And that diaspora has seeded, those double diaspora has seeded the world. You know, these tulkus from Tibet who are across America now, and this whole incredible Jewish diaspora has had a lot of beneficial results for the wide world in spreading that spirit and that energy and that intelligence in the Jewish community, and that deep moral fervor and mystical inclination. Now, I have a particular take on this, Mark. I do think that the whole witness of the Jewish tradition has been incarnation. And
that's great.
Now, that's where I come from. I came out of Sri Aurobindo to see all of the cosmic advance as one great psychophysical disclosure of the divine, that matter is good. Matter is not, as many Gnostic cults said way back, that something to be escaped from. Not Maya, like many Vedantic, the Mayavada of India.
Mm-hmm.
This is illusion.
Mm-hmm.
The world is a witch. The world is dark and to be escaped from. No, in Aurobindo's vision, it's to be embraced and to become the vehicle of the divine disclosure. And that's what has animated me and led me. But, you know, some people, such as Paul Tillich, I mean, many, many historians have said that the people who most planted the flag for the progressive physical incarnation were the Jews, the idea of the Messiah and the eschaton. Now, that was the ancient way of saying it, but if you transmute that into a modern vision of a progressive disclosure of the divine in the flesh, you see, now, this is the most radical edge of Sri Aurobindo, and that's, I would say, the most radical edge of ITP, our integral transformative practice. The flesh itself is meant to manifest the glories of God.
Well, that,
it's
that
not
is, that
merely
is, that,
something to escape from. And
that's
think,
fantastic.
Yeah, I think it's profoundly Jewish myself. I mean, this is my view. And
well, I think, Michael, your intuition is actually so, you know, when I say your intuition, I just want to say something about intuition. And if Michael, if I can talk about, you know, our audience in third person for a second, you know, when Michael has an intuition, it's grounded in, you know, many, many, many years and, you know, hundreds of thousands of hours of deep kind of practice and reading and kind of a sense of things. It's an intuition that emerges with this very deep matrix. So I want to just, you know, just bow to that intuition, which I think is actually, you know, profoundly right on two levels. You know, one is if, you know, I was raised in a couple of different languages, Hebrew and English, but my earliest other language was Aramaic, you know, because, you know, the classical texts of Hebrew culture and Aramaic, I was trained as an Orthodox rabbi and was in Orthodox practice for most of my adult life, and so over our cup of green juice, we'll talk about that. But the word tikkun, which of course you're very familiar with, you know, T-I-K-K-U-N, is actually partially wrongly translated as to kind of to heal or to repair, although it does have that sense. But in the kind of text and what's called the tikkuni zohar, the tikkun of the zohar, which is a later strata, you know, mid-13th century of the Tsar, the word tikkun itself literally means, right, something like to evolve, and lest you think I'm retrojectively reading, actually Abraham Cook, who you might call kind of like a Jewish Aurobindo. They're very close in their kind of sense of things. When I read Aurobindo, I'm, you know, at these particular passages, I'm reminded of Cook actually says in a fantastic passage, which I'm going to make a public commitment in front of a few thousand people to send to you as soon as I get back to the States, you know, says that the process of tikkun, he says, is most accurately described. He's writing in 1920. He says, by the contemporary thinking of evolution, which most accurately captures the essential spirit of Razei Adonai, of the secrets of God expressed in Kabbalah, which is, you know, just utterly fantastic. Wow. And he talks about this unfolding revelation, and he uses the verse from Job chapter 19, Mipsari Echazeh Eloah, through my body I vision God. And what a fantastic. Yeah, I mean, it's just so, and so you've got this deep, and I love your language. You know, the word you used about four paragraphs back was, you know, incarnational.
Right.
You know, this kind of incarnational impulse in which, you know, and there's no accident that, you know, the church adopted this notion of the body of Christ. You know,
right.
The body of Christ as a living church, if you move it beyond its ethnocentric context, really captures, I think, what my academic teacher, Moshe Edel, when I wrote my thesis at Oxford.
Oh, for God's sake.
Yeah, Edel's fantastic. You know, it's, you know, called the kind of living impulse of the original Hebrew gnosis. So that's fantastic. I'm just so delighted to hear that sense of the incarnational impulse that animates, you know, your own work. And I think your intuition, you know, as I said, which is obviously an informed and depth intuition, not a casual comment, is just completely on the money. I think that really is the evolutionary context, is really the essence of Luria. I mean, it's what it's all about. So that's just, I'm just delighted, you know, by that. And I don't want to take our listeners off track as I get, you know,
seduced. Well, I think to bring it back, Mark.
Yeah,
I am,
please.
Well, I'm thrilled to hear this. I, you know, to bring it back to this integral idea, you know, this is why
please.
We have put such a premium on the body in this practice. And I, my devotion to sport, and to, you know, I've written, you know, these books about this, that in the title, The Future of the Body, I mean, it could be more aptly named The Future of Human Nature, but we did put an emphasis on that. And, you know, I've been able to write off, you know, as an IRS expense, all my interviews with athletes, see, with my favorite team. And my first book, Golf in the Kingdom, was a, you know, a tall Irish tale about one Michael Murphy who met one Shiva's Irons. It's, you know, the best-selling book I've written. And 38 years ago.
Golf in the Kingdom.
In the Kingdom. Yeah, and it's
Golf in the Kingdom. So everyone go out and get that. We got to sell another couple thousand copies today. It's actually a great book.
Well, thank you. But anyway, it's 1972, and Mark, I've been taking confession from golfers ever since about their mystical experiences and kind of occult phenomena on golf courses. It's a secret hiding in plain sight, and it opened up to me then other sports and then the mysticism of everyday life, that how frequent these extraordinary, supernormal experiences, you know, are in various situations, and Future of the Body is very much rooted in that discovery process. We had we collected 10,000 studies. They're all housed down at UC Santa Barbara now, but out of that came The Future of the Body, and a group of us studied these things, and it's still a gold mine there, Mark, waiting to be uncovered, how many of these experiences happen. But they typically happen to folks who are not seeking mystical experiences. They're not in a religious context. They might not even have any kind of coherent worldview consciously, an unconscious worldview, but they have these experiences, and to me, these are signals of the transcendent that are breaking into the common life all the time. But in sport, because people make such a profound sacrifice, some of these athletes, you know, of their, they are doing willy-nilly a kind of, well, it is truly a transformative practice, but not in the name of some higher consciousness, but rather to win the game or perfect the body or to succeed in dance or in the beauty. But these practices have inherent goods. And so this all bears witness to this urge in human nature to be more physical, but in this, you know, this is maybe overstating, in this divinized way, though one doesn't think of it that way. But as you stretch yourself with these practices, graces are given. You know, Sri Aurobindo chose as his symbol the Star of David. And the two triangles, the bottom one that points up, being representing matter, aspiring back to its divine source, and the top triangle coming down is the answering grace of the divine, which always remains in and of itself, waiting to attract that part of the world which has fallen away or hidden itself from the face of the divine. So those two intersecting triangles, and then Aurobindo had in the middle of the Star of David there, the lotus, which is you know, an ancient Indian symbol of the opening of the heart, and actually his name, Aurobindo, it actually means in Bengali, the red lotus. And so anyway, again, you know, these amazing correspondences in today's global village.
Well, I mean, I just have to say, Michael, if you'll allow me some Jewish chutzpah, right? Although I've kind of moved from that ethnocentric Jewish context to a more world-centric context, you know, I still haven't lost the chutzpah. You know, just listening to you talk and the, you know, not just the content of what you're saying, which is of course fantastic and deep, and I've read you, you know, over the last several years, you know, but just in the very utter delight of your engagement, You know, just the kind of energetic, the light, the subtle body. You know, I think you yourself, Michael, are one of the signals of transcendence. You know, that phrase that you pulled out there, I think from Peter Berger, from his old book, Rumors of Angels.
That's right.
You know, just the delight. Yeah, just
that's
imagine.
Right.
Just
to, uh-huh.
That, right? Just,
that's exactly where I got it.
Yeah, it's a fantastic phrase. But, you know, just the, you know, and just one of the litmus tests for an emerging, evolutionary emergent is that very delight. Now, I just want to, if I can just, Michael, move to third person for a second, point that out to everyone listening. And as you listen to kind of just the utter delight and excitement and, you know, the kind of freshness. You know, freshness is a great word. It's both, you know, from German. I'm in Germany now. And in English, freshness is both a kind of chutzpah, a kind of audacity, and a kind of newness, where there's a kind of, there's an edge to it. There's an edge of newness. It's fresh. And it's fresh in a kind of wonderful chutzpah and audacity. And I think all of your work, Michael, you know, the Baal Shem Tov, my lineage master in Hasidism, said that the purpose of Hasidism was to bring, he said, freshkeit to the Kabbalah. You know, freshkeit in that kind of.
Right. What's the word?
Isn't that great? He called it freshkeit.
Freshkeit.
You know, which is, yeah, kind of Yiddish, German, you know, freshkeit, that kind of.
Freshkeit.
That kind of chutzpah. Yeah, freshkeit, that newness and that audacity.
Yeah.
And just, you know, and I just hear that, you know, in all of you, again, not just the content, but in, you know, in just the delight in your voice. And it just animates and, you know, vivifies, you know, just everything that this is about. So I just want to, just a deep, you know, public bow and gratitude to you for not only for the content and not only for the trailblazing, but for that, you know, utter delight, you know, in your work and in your voice today. We really all are in your debt, and I mean that really as an understatement, because it's really not in anything. There's no sense of overstatement in it. So a deep, deep thank you in that sense.
Well, thank you, Mark. I mean, this is a ton of fun. I mean, this is so great. Listen, we got to get together when you're. Back
we absolutely. Even though we're on the air, I'm going to get your. I have your email, but I'm going to get, because Ken, I think, sent it to me. But I'll get your number, and I'm going to call you as soon as I get back. And for green juice. But in our last 27 minutes,
okay.
Right, I've got to take advantage. I want to go back to one thing that you mentioned in passing. Although you said we don't have time to go into it, but you've of course, you know, being the boundary breaking, you know, audacious, you know, kind of Jewish guy, I can't resist. Especially when you said that we're not going to have time for it. So I want to go to what you mentioned in passing when you talked about affirmation and vow-taking. And the reason that that's interesting, you know, to me and to many of the people in our conversation today, it's something that we just talked about to Claudio Naranjo a couple of weeks ago. My partner in Center for World Spirituality is Mariana Kaplan, who, by the way, just gets a Mazel Tov. She just won a whole bunch of books for awards for the Best Spirituality Book of 2009.
What's his name?
Her name, Mariana Kaplan.
Her new book is
you remember her book Halfway Up the Mountain a few years back? It was about
Yeah.
Of course, you're completely stuck on the air when someone asks you that, and the answer is no. So you know that very well. I apologize. Her new book is called Eyes Wide Open: Cultivating Discernment on the Spiritual Path. And you know, she's close to Claudio, who was in his own way, you know, a pioneer. And one of the topics back then, and we said to Claudio Naranjo that we wanted to talk about this with you, and he mentioned Esalen as being, by the way, very formative at a very formative time in his life. He said Esalen created the context for him to be able to kind of gather and evolve, you know, his particular contribution. So there you were again.
He's, you know, by the way, Claudio was a prodigious generator of many activities and ideas that I don't think he's been duly credited for. He was a tremendous pioneer, and then he tends to be one of these traceless arhats, you know, the Buddhist race.
Mm-hmm.
He
mm-hmm.
doesn't leave a big, chest thumping trail behind him. And, he was one of the very important Esalen in the early years.
Yeah, no, and he said, we told him we were going to be talking to you, and he said to please send his both his love and his admiration and his gratitude for really creating that house that so many people were able to live in and evolve in. And particularly, we said we talked to you as we began to talk to him about the idea of, and this is why I'm double-clicking, if I can borrow that term from technology, I'm double-clicking on vow-taking, the idea of obligation, right? The idea of obligation, which, you know, we kind of, You know, so much of secular humanism understood implicitly obligation to be kind of an old, you know, mythic meme, you know, Gebser's, you know, mythic membership, you know, level of consciousness, you know, kind of externally imposed obligation. And obligation kind of got lost. And it's one of the great critiques of, you know, what we might call conservative society at its best in America is that liberal society has kind of lost its sense of obligation, you know, of that kind of profound commitment where you really experience obligation. Of course, as you know very well, you know, in Jewish practice, in its ideal form, the idea of mitzvah, you know, means not good deed but commandment. So obligation is really core. And as you talk about vow taking, I can't help but be, you know, opened up to this idea of creating an obligation. You know, is that, you know, a kind of creating the sense?
Well,
is that a right read?
It's a complex thing for me, Mark, because so many obligations that people experience are truly prisons and destructive forces. And I think we had to go through Freud and the illumination of what he called the superego and the internalization of society's commands. And to be in the global village is to now be presented with contradictory superegos. I grew up in Salinas in as an Episcopalian altar boy.
Is that right?
Yeah. And
wow.
My parents were not churchgoers, but I was just religious by nature. And so I introjected a lot of very tough commands to myself. And when I got to Stanford, and I then encountered a lot of intellectual commands to think clearly and with critical detachment, I suddenly had another introject, another superego. Let's call it, for simplicity's sake, science and religion. And then I got to Sri Aurobindo, and I interjected that, and I caught fire, and I gave up sex, remained a virgin till I was 32. I gave up eating meat. I gave up making money. And my father then said, "You're on your own, son, now," you know, because I'd been a star student and here, you know, I'd had a scholarship to Harvard, but I decided I want to go to Stanford. Stanford had a better football team. I was a sports fan. But in any case, so here I had competing interjects. And Esalen has been largely about the liberation from crippling obligations. And this is one of the great working through. Think of these Muslim women under Sharia and under the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. The inhumane part of the religious commandment that so many Muslim women are having to wrestle with worldwide. The cruelty of religions.
Yeah.
The cruelty. And as Houston says, yes, the religions give us depth and tradition, and they give us cruelty.
Yes, absolutely.
And this is part of what we're working through as modern people.
Yep.
But the power of vows, which is the final answer, or one of the final answers to the challenge that Houston gave us at the beginning of this conversation, against dilettanteism.
Yes.
The power of vows is to invoke our power of volition, of will, and of ideas, but they have to be lined up with our soul. This is Fritz Perls at Esalen made a big distinction between self-actualization, you know, Abe Maslow's phrase,
right,
and self-ideal actualization. In other words, in my case, the ideal was I was kind of, as growing up, I was kind of an ultimate goody two-shoes. Norman Mailer, the writer who we became friends, he said, you know, Mike, God bless you, you're overbred. And
that's what a wonderful phrase.
Yeah, well, listen, I've run it ever since. Like a poodle, you know, overbred. Too many interjects. You know, there are certain people that are so good that, you know, being around them gives you diabetes. I mean,
overbred with too many interjects is such a great sentence. I'm on
anyway,
the floor.
You've got, you know, and so much of being a modern person is to break out of these. This is the women's lib movement. This is the, well, let's just start with, you know, the whole, race relations in America. Let's say black liberation. Okay, the women's movement, the gay movement. The human race is like this big old dog that's just shaking off, you know, like a dog shaking off this, all these false interjects. We have got to break free. But with that freedom to align ourselves with what I believe and with what all of us involved in this ITP thing I believe is that we have something, a depth you would call a soul. Now, this is, we only got 15 minutes left here, but,
right.
You know, there are depths of soul. I think this
is one
of the great blessings of the comparative witness in the global village. What do you mean by soul? Atman is Brahman. That is one of the great bottom lines. The ultimate subjectivity, which is Atman, is one with Brahman, the omnipresent reality. But there's also this dynamic soul. This is in Aurobindo, let's call it the double soul, man. The double soul, the Shakti, the Shekinah that comes emanating out into the world, not as a cultural interject, but as a primal power. Now, boy, this is complicated, and we have to talk about it. But when we make vows, what our rule in ITP is that you have to work with your vows. Not all vows are created equal. For example, there was one lady who, so we said, okay, we have to make vows in the realm of the body, then in the realm of our relationships, realm of the heart, we said, in the realm of the mind, and in the realm of spirit. This was one of the formulations. And one vow for something supernormal. So one lady made a vow that she was going to become a subpar golfer. So she had never played golf. So I had to talk to her about this, that this is beyond the supernormal, just for anyone to become a subpar golfer. This is unrealistic. In other words, we can vow things that are deeply out of touch, first with common sense and then with reality, but with out of our soul. You can make a vow to improve your golf game, but that's different than, so this would be the difference between self-actualization and self-ideal actualization. So vow-taking gains in power to the degree that it can align itself with soul. Now, how do you know? Your soul, that is a work in progress. That is why we have to practice. This is why we need a developing community that, in which we can help each other find what is our deepest soul. You know, in the Hindu tradition, the saying in the Bhagavad Gita, it is better to fail in your own dharma, that's the deep law of your life, than to succeed in somebody else's. So for me, when I was at Stanford, and you know, I was in pre-med, and I was thought I was going to be a psychiatrist. And after I lit up when I heard all this from Frederick Spiegelberg, there, actually it was at the end of my sophomore year at Stanford. But then I really sunk into it when I came back from my junior years, and then I lit up and I took my vows. And the first thing I did was quit medical school. I had no more aptitude to be a doctor. It was something that, you know, my grandfather was this truly saintly doctor, and everyone thought I was like him, and it kind of got into me and into my mind when I was about 10 or 11, and when I saw that I didn't have the aptitude and I didn't have the calling for it, it was such a liberation, Mark, I can't tell you. Well, now listen, countless people have been through this, of finding, you know, better to fail in your own dharma than to succeed in somebody else's. So, vow-taking, I would argue, we all argue about this, and George Leonard was very creative around this, that it's important and effective to the degree that it can align with your deepest nature, with your soul. So there's, I think there's a lot to be learned about this, and I think James Hillman, you know, the Jungian psychologist, calls it the soul's code.
Right.
And
he wrote a book
called The Soul's Code. I think it's a very good book. It goes back to Plato, and it's there at the heart of all the mystical traditions. But but I think what's new now for us in the global vision is that we can link that idea of the soul's code into this evolutionary vision, that the world itself, that our soul is in alignment with the world soul, and how and you get that alignment. But each of us is unique. I do believe, and ITP was founded on the premise that each of us is unique. So that we're merely Atman is Brahman. In addition to that, there is a unique soul that is involved in the world game.
I've got to jump in, Michael. This is so exciting, and I've got to jump in here, and I'm actually devastated that we only have, and with all you thousands of people listening, I've got to tell you, with all blessing to you, you know, I'm just really here to talk to Michael. I'm not even sure why you're listening in. This is such a great conversation. You've said so much here, but I just want to pop in at one place here because, you know, the idea of the kind of Atman is Brahman on the one hand, you know, where you have the kind of the infinite subjectivity that lives as the divine, you know, the kind of radical subjectivity that is, you know, what I've sometimes called the puzzle piece dharma of enlightenment, you know, that your radical subjectivity is paradoxically what collapses you into divinity, you know, and then you have that kind of in this kind of dialectical tension with the double soul, with the kind of impersonal arousal of the kind of Shiva Shakti principle, and how that plays in a vow and what that means is just so unbelievably important. So I want to just share with you, just to get your resonance on it. I can't quite resist. So I apologize. I just finished, you know, and I'm going to send this to you, a work which is called The New Enlightenment, Awakening Your Unique Self. And unique self, not as an egoic construct, right, not as something which kind of is your Myers-Briggs test, but actually rooted in, you know, a couple of thousand pages I wrote with, you know, Edel at Oxford on the Kabbalistic category of a kind of post-transcendent realization in which your Buddha nature, as you know, as it were, right, doesn't yield a kind of generic Atman as Brahman, doesn't yield what our, you know, what my colleague and friend Andrew calls the authentic self, which is really, really an Aurobindo category, some form of psychic being, some play with that, but actually you yields an ultimately personalized essence beyond the impersonal. The personal kind of comes back online, and Shekhinah appears uniquely, not just because we have different social cultural conditioning, but because, as Luria said it, you know, we each are a kind of particular letter in the cosmic scroll. And I just want to just throw this at you and just hear any response, because I'm so excited about your response to it. When you read Luria in the 16th century text, where I've spent probably too much of my life, you know, there's a notion that when a person's born, they take a vow, and the vow is to live their unique self, right? To live that particular letter in the Torah, which is both the source of a person's existence and the obligation of their lives. And it seems like this rich, you know, load of texts that, you know, I've spent so much time on, just passionately in love with, and tried to articulate. And Ken and I, Wilbur and I, had a large argument for 4 or 5 years about this. Ken thinking that I was talking in an egoic strain until he actually read the large work on this, and we kind of came on board and developed this unique self thing and just ran an integral spiritual experience called the unique self. And it seems like we need to be even more deeply informed than I thought by really everything that you've been talking about in terms of, you know, vowing. And here comes the question mark, and this is the last statement before the question mark. My realization personally in this call, and if the listeners hear my excitement, right, you're absolutely right. You know, my realization in this call, Michael, is that I actually have much more to learn from you than I even thought. You know, I knew from reading your work that there was a lot here, but I'm just kind of blown away by the richness and the subtlety of your thinking and the subtlety that underlies, you know, the blazing steps that you've taken, which are more than just a kind of audacity, but a kind of holy chutzpah rooted in a very, very deep lineaged, you know, kind of access. So I mean, all of that leads to, you know, that would it be fair to say that your vow, right, that your obligation, right, is real, it's a genuine obligation, but unlike that of the kind of the churches or the dogmas or even the oversoul, right, it's an ultimate unique obligation. Yes.
Mark, I'm back.
Oh, we lost you there.
Yeah, I was lost for a minute or two, but I got back on. I don't know. Somehow we got cut off.
Oh, that's hilarious. That's hilarious. Well, so let me give you the question mark of what I was actually just sharing with you this incredible excitement about what you're saying. And I was wondering to myself, you know, Michael's being very quiet, so I guess I'll go on talking here. So let me give you just that's hilarious. The short version is like this. When I was at Oxford, Michael, I wrote my thesis on what's been the passion of my life, which I've called the unique self. And the unique self is not an egoic expression, but it's a post-transcendent realization, and it's post-realizing your true nature in some classical enlightenment sense, or at least having a glimmer of your true nature as true self, as, you know, total number of true selves is one. You actually realize that you have what Luria calls a unique letter in the cosmic scroll.
Yeah.
A unique letter in the Torah. And that letter
That's a metaphor, I take it, for an ultimate uniqueness in each soul.
An ultimate uniqueness, which is it's kind of the realization that, yeah, absolutely, that enlightenment actually has a perspective, that it's actually not, you don't stop at Buddha nature in the generalized sense of Atman is Brahman, you know, but that actually that your ultimate subjectivity in Luria's language creates a shvuah, right? Listen to this, creates an obligation and an oath. He said the vow that a soul swears upon being born is to live its own unique letter in the Torah.
What a powerful thing. Oh yeah, okay.
And that seems to be, and here's the question mark, and that is, you know, when I, and please correct me here, because this is one of the many places where I have much to learn from you, but when I read Aurobindo, and again, to be very clear, I don't have intuitions in Aurobindo, and I think you know what I mean by that. In Kabbalistic text, you know, it's like breathing to me, and so I can fall into an Aramaic text and kind of feel the text the way I can feel the palm of my hand. And Aurobindo, I'm an outside reader, I'm a guest.
Yeah.
And, you know, having said that, and, you know, my friend and colleague, you know, Andrew Cohen, who talks a lot about authentic self and who is clearly kind of taking a page from Aurobindo, you know, in a very, you know, direct and good way. But, you know, when Andrew talks about it and about Aurobindo, he talks about the awakening of an impersonal function beyond ego. And unique self, you know, emerging out of this Kabbalistic matrix, and I think also, by the way, Michael, very strong in Ibn Arabi, and in a kind of Sufi place,
This is a great frontier to be explored.
This is it, right? Isn't it? This is really
this
the frontier
is crucial.
Now.
And you know,
it really is.
I must say,
I'm so excited to be talking to you about this.
Well, okay. You know, Esalen, I started a new initiative at Esalen 12 years ago, going back to William James, radical empiricism, to look empirically at the question of what goes on after death without the faith claims of the traditions. So we've been at this, and the first big book came out called Irreducible Mind. This is a group of about 40 neuroscientists, philosophers, meditation teachers, and others working this in the spirit of the old Society of Psychical Research. And working with Ian Stevenson's 2,600 case studies of children.
From University of Virginia, right? Or something
life.
Like that. Right,
they
right.
remember a past life, and then Ian Stevenson for 50 years checked out. So it raises the issue of reincarnation.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's in play here. Now, in our Aurobindo scheme...
That's in play for sure in the unique self conversation. The Tulku conversation comes into play there.
Well, is that... So you're open to that?
Yeah, completely.
Well,
completely.
All right. So for now, in our Aurobindo scheme, the psychic being or the evolving soul... is a co-creator of the cosmic game.
Mm-hmm.
Each of us is an evolving soul rooted in Atman and Brahman, but absolutely unique, and Aurobindo cites a line which is there in the Rig Veda and finds its way into the Upanishads, and it is that two birds, friends and comrades, one eats the sweet fruit, the other observes and eats not. That line is an enigmatic, esoteric line.
That's fantastic.
It goes down. So he interprets it as the one that eats the sweet fruit is the evolving soul that has entered this cosmos, this evolving cosmos, to play the world game, but always retains its roots in Atman and Brahman.
Mm-hmm.
So now, if you take the root of Ramana Maharshi,
right,
you know, who influenced Andrew Cohen, by the way, through Punjabi.
Right, through Punjabi, who Kripal wrote about also, right?
Who?
I think you're Jeffrey Kripal, I think, wrote
Jeff Kripal's written about all this, but Ramana Maharshi, now that's right,
right.
You know, not Ramakrishna, but Ramana Maharshi.
I apologize. I was mistaken. That's right, Ramakrishna. I apologize.
Yeah.
Yes, go ahead.
Well, Ramana Maharshi, you know, who was rooted in this traditional thing of Atman Brahman, people would come from all over the world just to watch him read the newspaper. I mean, Somerset Maugham immortalized him in the Razor's Edge. But anyway, that grand tradition, Sri Aurobindo honored that, but said that, yes, you can rest and sit down in Brahman and stay there, but you can also enter into the world game, and that's what the individuating soul is doing in this great great adventure of incarnation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, so where I come from, in my understanding and in my practice, is that to root vow-taking in that psychic being, and I would now I want immediately to equate that with Lurias. I mean, that's your alphabet number, but the alphabet is as long as there are souls in the cosmos. I would.
That's right.
I think he would agree with that. In other words,
I think, for each
of us. We each have our own number on this cosmic football team, or whatever it is.
That's right.
So, but to take a vow to that is to be true to thyself.
Yeah.
To be true to yourself. And then thou canst be true to every man.
To any other,
you know?
That canst be false to any other man.
False to any man. I mean, that authenticity, and that's why I love Hillman's Soul's Code. It's there in Plato. It's lurking everywhere, but it is at odds.
It's lurking everywhere, and it's also an evolutionary emergent. It's kind of both, right?
It is. It's a developmental process. It's a deep self-actualization, and I do think we do have to be careful of overworking this thing of rejecting ego, something called ego. You know, certain words need to be rehabilitated, that we need a hospital for words, and we actually need a cemetery also. And the overworking...
What a great sentence.
But the overworking of ego, I mean... J.D. Salinger, as growing up, I loved J.D. Salinger, but, you know, he had Franny and Zooey, if you ever read him, you know, taking odds with this idea of ego, don't have too much ego. I mean, yes, absolutely, that means something very profound, that we have to get out of these homeostatic prisons we've got ourselves into and self-centered and et cetera. But there's also lurking this immense individuality, which is to be honored, and which give something absolutely unique to the world. And if we don't make that vow to, I never heard this about Lurie. I love this. If we don't make that vow, we rob the universe of its potential richness, I think. If we just cancel it in the name of Atman Brahman.
Yeah, no, that makes so much sense. And to maybe just finish with this intuition, you know, and this is, you know, I'm reminded, you know, as, you know, I've been delighted to have a number of really great conversations on world spirituality, but, you know, this conversation, most of all, I feel like I'm in Plato's Symposium, you know, and, you know, in that original sense of Greek eros, you know, where you feel like the conversation's barely just begun.
Right.
And so I'm not going to let you off the hook on that green juice.
Like you did in the symposium. We have to be up all night.
Oh my God! Michael, you're not off the hook on the green juice. There's no, and I just want to finish the conversation with just to say to everyone, there's so much more to say. And Michael, I said when you were off the line, you know, my great realization in this conversation, you know, is that I have much more to learn from you than I even thought. I've read some of your work and have known that you've been trailblazing and, you know, like we often do, got caught, you know, in Israel very much in my own. You know, trajectory of work, but I've known for a number of years that I need to find you in the world and that there's so much to talk about and to learn from you. And I'm just utterly, utterly delighted by the conversation. And I've gotten about 20 questions, which we're not going to take now in the webcast and the phone lines, but I sent an email to Kelly as we were talking that just the time to talk to Michael is actually at this point so valuable that we're actually going to hold on the questions. So I apologize to everybody on the line and particularly, you know, to people who wrote in fantastic questions. And I don't want to put Michael on the spot and indulge in his time anymore right now. But, you know, after we meet Michael, we'll see how we can do a second interview conversation. And just to say that, you know, all of us are, you know, in a real and a profound sense, not in any knee-jerk sense, and really just the deepest sense, in your debt and walking in many of the paths that you've laid down the groove in and participating with you in that evolutionary impulse. And I hope that you're also heartened by the conversation just to know the you know, once again, you know, the impact that you've made through your own, you know, infinite radical subjectivity, you know, living in you, as you, and through you, and the delightful and wondrous person of Michael Murphy. Thank you, Michael.
Well, Mark, thank you very, very much. And listen, to be continued.
To be continued. I'm going
to
send you.
I want to continue the conversation. So let's get together when you're back here. And thank you, everybody who's listening, and all of us. To be continued.
To be continued. Thank you, Michael. Shalom, shalom.
Shalom, shalom. Bye.
Shalom, shalom.